Welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Here's the host of the show, Bart Blair.
This is episode 32 of the Revitalize My Church podcast. My name is Bart Blair. I'm the director of church revitalization for Assist Church Expansion. It's my privilege to welcome you to another episode, assuming that you're not a first-time listener. If you happen to be a first-time listener, welcome to the show. We've been producing this podcast since the summer of 2024, releasing two episodes every month with the goal of helping churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. I have the privilege on the first of every month sitting with Nathan Bryant, the executive director of Assist Church Expansion, and we share insights and things that we are learning or have learned about the church revitalization and church renewal process. And then on the 15th of each month, we introduce you to someone that I know or someone that I've met who has some insights that really help us all grow and get better at being church leaders, church revitalizers, or church planter. Maybe you're a church planter and you're listening to this. Regardless of what your situation is, our goal, again, is just to provide you with tools, resources, insights, and information that can help your church be healthy and grow strong. I'm excited to introduce you today to a friend of mine, a ministry colleague, someone I've known for a few years, named Nick Blevins. Nick does a lot of things. You're going to hear a little bit of his story in the podcast episode in the interview that I'm going to roll for you here in just a minute. But Nick actually serves on staff at a church in the Baltimore, Maryland area called Community Christian Church. Ironically, before I started working for Assist Church Expansion, I applied for a position, a pastoral position at Community Christian Church. I didn't know Nick at the time. I didn't get hired. In fact, I didn't even get interviewed for the position. A few years later, we found ourselves connected, doing some other ministry stuff together and built a relationship. And I told him that story. And he said, you know, the ironic thing is we never really hired anybody for that particular position. So I didn't feel as bad about being looked over at the time. But it's all worked out great because now I get to do this and I still get to do ministry with Nick, who I think you're going to find to be super, super insightful, especially as it relates to building volunteer ministry teams in your church. Nick's specialty is family ministry and children's ministry, and I know that a lot of churches that are in a revitalization or a renewal space are trying to figure out how to bolster their children's ministry. I've done several episodes this year in 2025 on this particular topic. Nick has a book called The Volunteer Playbook that I cannot recommend more highly, so I hope that you'll hop over to Amazon, give the book a look. Don't just give it a look, buy it. Buy it for your Kindle or buy a paperback copy. You won't regret it. You will not regret reading the book. It's got some really great insights, great tips, and he's going to share some of those with us in this episode today. Anyway, thanks again for tuning in to the Revitalize My Church podcast. Here's my recent interview with Nick Blevins. Hey, Nick Blevins, thanks so much for joining me today on the Revitalize My Church podcast.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me, Bart.
I always enjoy hanging out with you, Nick. We get a chance to meet from time to time and talk about all kinds of ministry things. You wrote a book a few years ago that I read. What year did you release your book?
2023, I think it was 2 years ago, but yeah. I don't know. It almost gets like kids when they get a certain age, you guys start really thinking, or like your anniversary, you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah, it's called The Volunteer Playbook, and you and I recorded another podcast episode for another podcast that I get to co-host, and I was just kind of going through all my list of people that I know, and I'm like, who can I invite on the show that could actually add some value to our audience, and I can't believe it took me this long to actually think of you, because we meet all the time.
I know where I am on the list. It's fine.
No, come on.
But what revitalizes a church more than volunteers? Maybe that's why you thought about it. It was the topic.
Well, yeah, I told you right before you and I started having this conversation, I was on a coaching call with one of the churches that I'm coaching through revitalization, and we were literally talking about volunteer recruitment. I'm like, well, you guys are going to have to wait for the podcast episode to come out, but go ahead and read the book in advance. It's called The Volunteer Playbook, and we're to spend part of our time today talking about volunteer recruitment and sort of a process that you outline in the book. We're also going to talk a little bit about a FEMA grant that is available to churches, nonprofits, and churches regarding some security things. We'll kind of land the plane there. But before we get into the discussion about sort of the volunteer recruitment and the process that you outline in the book, just share with everyone a little bit of your background in ministry, where you are, what you're doing, and how you ended up there.
Yeah, I say I've been in two churches my whole life. The one I grew up in that my mom took me to when I was 2 years old, and you know, this crazy 2 year old, she had to get introduced to Jesus to make me behave better, hopefully, or something like that. And was in that church until I married the pastor's daughter, which was great. Although at the time she thought she was marrying somebody who wasn't going to be a pastor, which was true. I went to work at Northrop Grumman out of college, and then decided, you know what, I think I want to do this church thing more than just a volunteer. And ended up jumping on staff with a church that was starting as a new church plant in 2006 here north of Baltimore, Maryland, called Community Christian Church. We will turn 20 years old in March of 2026. And I remember the launch like it was yesterday, as any church planter does. But I also feel like it's 80 years ago, not 20. So because same as any other church planter does. And so it, you know, been a great journey, you know, with Community Christian. I started leading our kids ministry, moved to leading all of our kids and student ministry in like 2011. And then now I do that as well as our operations. You know how it is in churches, you wear multiple hats, and I kind of enjoy all of it though. I'm like one of those people that I don't like the same thing all the time. So it's a lot of fun.
In addition to your serving in the church there at Community Christian, you also have a ministry partner outside the church, and you guys do some consulting and coaching. Share a little bit about that.
Yeah, we do. We actually started in 2016 with some coaching groups. We called them mastermind groups back then, which was a popular term in like the business world, but you didn't hear about it in the church world. And there were coaching groups. I was in coaching groups years ago with Tony Morgan, who I learned so much from. And I just really believe in coaching. And so we launched coaching groups for kids, student, and next-gen pastors back in 2016 and 17. And then in 2018, we launched a couple courses online that we were doing live to help recruit volunteers or help people learn how to lead kids ministry or student ministry. And then we turned that into Ministry Boost, a company we started in 2018. So it's been 7 years. And we mostly do online coaching courses and resources. And then we do work with church. Right now, I'd say the thing we're doing the most is we'll work with a church specifically, where we come in, teach their staff the recruiting framework that we talk about, and then we coach them on how to do it the next 5 months. And I have loved that part. That's been the part that's probably been the most fun. The same content, I mean, not everything, but a lot of it's in the book and a lot of it's in a course, but it's a lot more fun to come with a church alongside them, meet their team. And the other thing too is, I don't know about you, but you know, I there's years in my life where I had a gym membership I never went to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's never our heart with Ministry Boost. We don't ever want to be the course you buy but don't watch, or the book you buy but don't read. Like, we want you to do it, you know, because the whole point is to help your church. And so the coaching with church has been great because they're more likely to do it, you know, because right. We're there. Right. They're showing up on calls with us. So that's been a lot of fun. And we've been doing more of that recently.
I'm going to link to all your stuff in the show notes of this episode. You have a podcast as well that you host that's focused primarily on like next gen ministries, family and children's ministry.
Yep. It's kids, students, and next gen, whatever fits in there, whatever. It might be one specific one time, or it might be something like Partner with Parents that hits all of them. I just call it the Family Ministry Podcast. It had a little bit of an unplanned hiatus the last 2 years, Bart. You know how that goes. But it's back and it's rolling. And I love, just like you're doing, I love, you know, one of the reasons you and I talk so much whenever we get on a meeting together is because we just love learning from each other, talking ministry, who's doing what, what's working in some churches. And that's basically what we do on that podcast.
Yeah, I've learned a lot from you over the years and love hanging out with you, and really excited about this conversation today. Let's talk a little bit about this framework that you outline in your book. This is what you coach churches on. I'm assuming it's something that you learned in the trenches of ministry. Talk a little bit about what volunteer recruitment has looked like for you over the years at Community Christian. You've overseen, really, in most churches, I would say that the children's ministry, student ministry, those tend to be some of the most high demand in terms of volunteers, yet they often seem to be the ones that are the biggest struggle in terms of getting the teams built and equipped and consistently coached. Walk us through just sort of what the journey has been like for you, which led to you creating this framework that you have.
Yeah, that's great. And it has evolved over the years for sure. I mean, I'm like most kids ministry people. A lot of student ministry people might have went to college for it. It's less true now, but you know, from our generation, Bart, it was very normal to be like, I grew up in a church where my youth pastor talked about vocational ministry. Now, I didn't think it was for me, but you know, those that did went to a Bible college, maybe seminary, and student ministry, that's very common. And in children's ministry, that's not common at all. You know, 80% or more of children's ministry leaders are usually homegrown, which was me. I was in this town, not expecting to work in a kids ministry. And even if I had gone to a Bible college, Bart, you know how it is. How many people learn to recruit volunteers in their Bible college or seminary?
Right.
Like almost nobody. I've hardly met anyone that's ever said, that's a question we'll ask at a conference and a breakout. Like, raise your hand if somebody showed you how to recruit volunteers. And it might be 2% of the room. Like, it's never many people. So I did what most people did for years, where it was, you know, can we get an announcement from stage? Can we put something in the program? Can I email that we need help here? You know, whatever. And then fortunately, through some great mentors over the years, learned some better tactics. And, you know, the stage announcement sometimes will get you people, but a lot of people will say yes and then don't follow through. And then the framework that we came up with, it's so funny when we teach this to churches too, because every time this happens, if we teach it in a workshop or with a church staff, there's at least one person that will come up and say, you know what? We did something similar to this when I worked in this sales job, or when I worked at this university where we were trying to get students to come to our college, or where I worked in, you know what I mean? And all they're speaking to is like a process, you know, my marketing, they might call it a funnel. And that can have a lot of bad thoughts to it. Like, you hear marketing, you hear funnel, you think sales or leads, and you think, oh, that sounds sleazy, which it could be. You could be like, it could be like a car salesman. But what we always say is, we're not selling timeshares or cars. We are inviting people in to join God on mission to make disciples. And this is something we can be bold about. When we're inviting people to serve and to volunteer, it's not for us. It's not even for the church. It's for them and their faith and their walk with God. And so we can be bold and ask them, yes, I don't just want you to add this serving opportunity to your list of things and it's 57th on your list. I want you to put it in the top five. Like, that's how bold I'm, and I could be that bold, because I know that if you do that and you experience serving in this church and being part of God's ministry and mission for the world, you will thank me for it, you know, 6 months from now. So what we built was a five-part framework. All you have to do is think of it like, what are the steps somebody might take to go from being in your church but not serving to on a team and serving? And so we, you know, the book and courses teach the five steps. And the part that I think is the easiest part, although when we work with a lot of church leaders, they don't do it quite like we think they should, even though I think it's the easiest part, is the first step is prospects. Like, do you have enough prospects in your pool, or think of names on a list to talk to in order to get the number of volunteers you need? And so once you do that, the first step is prospects, and then it's conversation, meaning like, if you were a name on my list, Bart, and I didn't know you, somehow I need to get in a conversation with you. And that might start over email or text or in the lobby or whatever. But once I'm talking to you, now we're in a conversation. And then I'm going to get you into orientation, which we talk about differently than most people think. Get them onboarding into the role, which a lot of churches lose people in this process, in that part, you know, in the onboarding part. And then they're placed. And if you run that five-part framework and manage it well and communicate through it well, and you put enough prospects in the beginning of it, you can recruit the volunteers you need. You can actually have, which is shocking for a lot of kids ministry people to think, but you can actually have 95% to 100% of the volunteers you need.
I think it's really remarkable. I think, as I've observed churches over the years, the area where most churches fail is actually in the onboarding process. And that's the part that I want to kind of do a deeper dive with you today, because I think when we have a good, clear onboarding process, it sets our new ministers up for success. If we don't have a clear onboarding process, it's a crapshoot as to whether or not they're going to stick and whether or not it's going to work. If we can make it a win for them as we're onboarding them, they're more likely to have success and actually stick with it. I do want to go back to something you said just a minute ago and thought that was kind of going through my mind as you're talking about looking at the prospects and making those asks. I think a lot of times we get too apologetic when we're asking people to serve in ministry. As church leaders, as pastors, I think we know it. We just don't necessarily always live it, that people serving in ministry is actually great for them and their own spiritual formation, right? We're trying to grow people into better, more reflections of Jesus, more consistent in their faith journey, deeper relationship and experience with God. And if they're not engaged and they're not serving and they're not living out the gifts and the calling that God has placed on their lives, they're never going to live to the full potential that's in them. And we really have a responsibility to guide them into the places where they can do that. Now, sometimes it might take some experimentation. You know, children's ministry may not be the right thing, right? But until you mm-hmm. get it and you try it, you may not know. So I think that I think we need to be more confident and more courageous in those asks, because it really is good for the people that we're inviting to serve.
It is. And I think you can even say things like, trust me, you'll come up and thank me 6 months from now. Because will they? Probably. Every now and then it might not work out. Or maybe, like you said, it's not the right ministry fit. And so they need to move to another ministry, which that's great. That's still a win. But you could say, hey, you're going to thank me 3 months from now, 6 months from now. Trust me, you're going to come thank me for this. And I do think one of the things I have believed is that, you know, since the pandemic, churches, this has been even harder for church leaders every time we talk to church leaders. And I don't think that the pandemic itself necessarily made it harder. In one way, I think maybe. I think it more just exposed the weakness we already had in recruiting volunteers and just made it even more obvious. The one way I do think it made it a little bit harder is people were even less willing to commit now than they were before. Mm-hmm. And because we all experienced however long, a year or 18 months of like a less busy schedule. And so even if you're not consciously thinking it, there's part of you that's back there thinking, I don't want to go back to that. Like, I don't want to go, you know what I mean? And so I think we have to be even more bold with people. My neighbors, we got a couple who goes to our church. They have 3 kids. They live through the woods here from my house. They've been a part of church for a long time. They should be serving. I have communicated with them through this framework. Probably, if you just think of actual communications, like an email, a text, a phone call, I've met with the husband years ago, probably 20 times over 3 years trying to recruit them. I've not succeeded yet. I'm not giving up. And every time I end up in a new like recruitment phase, they avoid me in the lobby. Like they don't look at me, you know, like they look away. They're the nicest people in the world. But for like 6 weeks when I'm trying to recruit them, you know, they're not looking at me. And then, you know, school starts, I see them back to school night and we're good to go, you know. But yeah. The moment I start recruiting, and there's going to come a point real soon, probably in the next few months, where I'm actually going to say, hey, I'm going to catch them on a Sunday and it's going to be real bold. Like, hey, I know I've reached out a bunch of times about serving here and you guys haven't taken that step. What's keeping you from that? You know?
Yeah.
Because now yes, I'm an Enneagram 8. It's a little more natural to my personality, but I think we could all do this because of what you said. We are being bold, not for selfish reasons, not for, because I don't even need them to serve in my kids in student ministry, though that's what I want because they're awesome. Like I would love for either one of them to be the small group leader for one of my kids. But if I did this and they end up serving in as an adult small group leader, that's a huge win. And I would love to see that. You know what I mean? So, or even if, I don't know, we talked to the dad and he's like coaching baseball and he wants to make that his ministry. And he's going to do it for real. Not like, hey, I coach and someone pretend like that's serving. But like he's inviting, you know what I mean? Like my student pastor does this with the soccer team he coaches. I would be all behind that. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't feel bad about it. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about the onboarding process. I'm assuming that you agree with me that if we fail to onboard people well, we don't set them up for success. And we're probably going to end up recruiting the same to fill the same positions over and over and over again. Let's talk through your framework for the onboarding process. As you've outlined it in the book, the first phase is this observation phase. That's what you call that. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. And let me back up real quick, because I agree with you. Churches lose people here. One, like if you're thinking, and part of the reason we have a framework is because if you have steps, you can figure out what step it's working and which steps aren't working. Mm-hmm. And of the 5 steps that I shared, the 2 that churches don't do the best at are the prospects. They don't contact enough people about serving. And then the onboarding, because they lose them. Like even if they raise their hand and say yes. In fact, we just did a call with a church that we're going to consult with in 4 weeks where we'll be out there, we'll train their whole staff. And they just did a push from stage because they're launching a 3rd service and they got 100 people that said yes to serving. And so sure enough, my first question was, how many are actually signed up to serve? Like how many are actually serving? You know, they launched the service in 10 days or whatever. And they thought through it and they're doing some math and each of them are counting and they came up with about 60. So 60% of the 100, which if it's a call from stage, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, those tend to have more people that flake out, you know, say yes and don't follow through. But we talk to churches all the time where they'll tell you, yeah, for every 10 people that raise their hand, only about 3 make it. And I'm like, okay, that's a red alert. You know, the way we teach it, which is a little different than normal, you should keep 90% of the people that get to the point where they say they're in, maybe 80 on the low end. And a lot of the ones you're not going to keep, it's because something was there that was a red flag that you don't feel like it's ready, or, you know, they, maybe they go to a different ministry or something like that. So you people, it's no different than sitting in service and the pastor's teaching a message. You're like, I need to do that. I need to do that. And you write it down. Maybe you're even praying about it. And then Monday hits. And like, do you remember that you needed to do it? And Wednesday hits. You know, we just have to have some, you know, grace for that's how we all are at times. And that's what people do. They sign up to serve. So a good onboarding process has to have great communication. You cannot fall through the cracks, I guess is the way I would say it. Like, if you don't make it through this, it's because you ghosted us, not because we dropped the ball with you. And so I like observation for that first step. Again, you can make up your own 7 parts or 4 part, onboarding plan. I like observation because it's very easy and you come see it. We can talk about a lot of people, especially think kids ministry. You don't even know what all the roles are, how it works, what you might like, what you don't like, what age group you might prefer. So let's come see it, because when you see it, we will also talk about it. And I will tell stories about Keith, who I call Keith the Baptizer, because he has led fourth and fifth grade boys for over 30 years. And he has literally baptized probably 30 or 40 fourth and fifth grade boys. And I'll introduce you to Keith. But then we'll come around here and I'll also introduce you to Jim, who just started serving in our fourth and fifth grade room this summer. And now he's stuck for this fall. And so that, you know, Jim raised his hand, said he wanted to serve. He did try it out.
Wait, let me stop you there. He has stuck, not he is stuck for the fall. Right?
Yeah. He's not stuck. He actually likes it.
He's sticking around for the fall, right?
He is one of the ones that would come up and say, thank you. I'm so glad you asked me. You know what I mean? And I like to tell different stories. Like, you got Keith, who's done it for 30 years. You got Jim, who's in there for 3 months. And on an observation helps with that. It also helps with, this is just my belief, I have no idea, but I feel like every prospective volunteer who hasn't said yes yet has a lot of fears that they're not saying out loud and not even really thinking directly, but they're there. Will I look stupid? Will you keep me till Jesus comes back? Will I know enough to do what you want me to do? What if I don't like it, this role? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And their answer to that is almost always, I'm just not going to do it, because I don't want to get in a position where then I have to say something like, I don't like this, or I don't know if I'm ready. And if you do an observation or something like that, you can take away all those fears. Because it's like, hey, look, here's where it is. Here's where we put the curriculum. Here's where the team meets before they greet in the parking lot. Here's what leading a small group of adults, you know, looks like. And so you almost answer the fears, the questions they have that they're not even asking, you know. So I love starting there, kind of make it. And plus it gets a little more relational, you know, step one. And then they're, you know, onboarding has a lot of logistics and things you got to handle, background checks and screening and vetting. And so let's start with the relational part. Let's win them with the vision while they're seeing it in action.
Okay. So first phase is observation. They're not serving the first day that they raise their hand. They're going to come and watch, and then you're going to talk about it and debrief with them. And then the second, you say thorough vetting. Talk through that.
Yeah, I think nowadays, far more churches are doing this better, which is great. But to me, the pieces of that include an application. And the more, like in our world, if you're serving with kids and students, you're filling out the most in-depth application. Our church actually has a church-wide application that is very simple. And for some ministries, like our guest services, that's all you need. And then there's a secondary application for ministries that need more, like kids, students, maybe even our adult small groups. And you fill that out, and there's more to it. We're asking you about your journey and your faith. How'd you get connected to the church? What was your journey like before that? What churches are you, you know, maybe you were coming from before? All the normal stuff in there too. References. Are you calling these references? Are they filling out a form? And then you can contact them. Like, you have to figure that out. And then I do like an interview as part of that with somebody. And that's a lot of times where you can ask the questions that, I mean, you could ask them on an application, like open-ended. But a lot of times that's better in person. And, you know, we just can't be too careful. We just cannot be too careful, you know, with this. And so this is the part where there's a tension, because you can feel like this is slowing the process down. And it kind of is. But there's a way where you can do it where we onboard volunteers in 2 weeks while doing all these steps. So you just, as long as they're following up on time, you can make it. Quick.
Let me address, Nick, a different tension that a lot of the people who are probably listening to this podcast are feeling at this point. And that is that many of us are in much, much smaller churches than your church. And we actually already have some level of relationship with the people that we're inviting to come in and participate in these ministries. And so, in fact, in some cases, in one of our recent podcast episodes, I interviewed a lady who actually taught us how to actually start a children's ministry, because a lot of our churches don't even have them to begin with. So right now there's nothing to observe, but I do still think that there needs to be some level of formality. Without maybe necessarily even using the vetting word, because, hey, maybe this person's been a part of our church for 10 or 15 years. We know them very well. We know their story. We know their background. How might one tailor this vetting process in a small church environment that might be a little bit different than what you would do in a larger church?
Well, that's a good question. And I want to tell a story. I hope it's helpful to that. I think it fits all of this. I was in a breakout a few years back, probably like 6 or 7 years back now, where Doug Fields, who's well-known in the student ministry world, in some ways like the godfather of student ministry, you know, student pastor at Saddleback for all those years. And he was asked this question about onboarding, like how long should it take? How fast? You know, because the longer it takes, it is true, the less people you'll get because they drop off. And he told a story about how years ago, this is probably like, you know, in the 80s or 90s, he said basically his principle is you got to have it buttoned up, planned out, you know, all the steps, you know how to communicate, and you can do it fast, like 2 weeks. However, you have to use your gut. And he told a story about a guy that wanted to serve their student ministry and was almost too eager, and it just didn't feel right to him. And so he trusted his gut and didn't like let the guy come right in, but he didn't tell him no either. It was more like, oh yeah, and he didn't say, hey, our process is this, but I don't trust you, so it's now this. But in his head, he adjusted it. It was like, instead of doing this, I also need you to go to our new here class, or actually I need to be in a group for 6 months. Like, and his point was, you adjust it based on your gut. And the sad part of the story is that, you know, that guy didn't serve there, but 2 years later he was in the news because of abuse.
All
he had
the
done
wrong things, right?
Another church had not sadly been able to do that vetting, and he got in where he shouldn't have got in. And so the principle from that is, use your gut and common sense and wisdom to adjust it. However, so for example, my church just messed this up. We had a guy named Rich, one of our best volunteers. He has led with fourth and fifth grade for years. And every year, my student pastor always jokes about recruiting him to move up with the fifth graders going to sixth grade so that he can have Rich in sixth grade. And my elementary director always fights him on it because she loves Rich and never wants to let him go. So it's really funny. Anyway, this year it actually happened. One of the fifth grade boys who's now sixth grade, Trent, requested Rich, like, Rich, would you move up and be my leader in sixth grade? And, you know, how do you say no to that? Now, I said, I think my student pastor is behind the scenes, like, scheming all this up. Like, he's paying Trent to ask Rich. But anyway, point is, I found out after the fact that we put Rich through another background check. He just had one a year ago, and we do it every 2 years. And he filled out the application. And it's like, what are we doing here? This is Rich. We already have an application. It's the same one. He already filled out a background check. It's the same one. So you do have to apply your own. Like, if you know them and they're trusted, you know, I just had a conversation today with a potential intern, and his references he wanted to give me were two other staff. And I'm like, oh, I'm good. We know you. Like, sorry, I should have told you we don't need that from you. You've been here for 4 years. So use your gut to adjust it, both faster or shorter. You know what I mean? I do think there's certain things like background check for everybody. Like, that's just, doesn't matter who you are. I don't care if I've known you for 30 years. But then there's some things that's like, yeah, you don't have to do that again. You know?
Yeah, I think what you're doing, especially in your early stages of building or rebuilding a children's ministry or student ministry or any ministry for that matter, what you do early on actually does set some precedents. So I do think it is important that you don't just completely disregard any formality or any process. You can always build, add to, modify later on. But having some sort of, hey, first, second, third step in the process that sort of formalizes it. I love the idea of an application. Even if I've known you for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, an application is a good idea, because we might get some information from you that we didn't have, and we can put that in our church management software, right? I love the idea of having, I don't know if you do this, but I love the idea of having an agreement, a ministry agreement that says, hey, you're agreeing that you're going to serve in this ministry from August of this year through July of next year, and we're going to sit down in May, and you will get to make your decision in May as to whether or not you're going to re-up for another year, or if I need to backfill the position for you in August of next year, right? Those simple little formalities, again, it sets the relationship in the right direction, right? It's what's the oh, I can't think of it. There's a book that I was thinking of that talks about people in relationship. Oftentimes when there's conflict in relationship, it comes because there are too many uncommunicated expectations at the outset. So more you're able to formalize and the more you're able to put down on paper so that everybody agrees, knows what we're agreeing to, the smoother things I think will go down the road.
Yes, for sure. I always say unspoken expectations lead to frustration. Yeah. I'm sure like a Henry Cloud would have better terms around that. Yeah. He would know more about that. I could tell you a million stories, Bart, of how we messed that up, you know? And so you do want to get it right. In fact, we just had a conversation yesterday about a leader who has been serving in a role and now there's might be a theological disagreement. And it's kind of like, okay, how do we not already know that? Because they're in a pretty high leadership role in one arena. They're trying to be a leader in another arena and it's coming to surface. And it's like, yeah, we should have known that.
Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about observation and then we do this vetting process, which would be application, background check, maybe some of the formalities there. And then you have the next step in there is in-depth interview, which I think we've already kind of hit on a little bit. And again, I think that's one of those areas where you just have to sort of customize it to the context of your church. Again, in a larger church, I think it's super, super important. In a smaller church, it may be a little less important and a little less formal, perhaps.
Yeah.
Then the next step you have is an intentional apprenticeship. Now, again, this might be a little bit trickier or a little more difficult in smaller churches that don't have, a full team yet, and they're still trying to build a team. But why don't you talk through what that intentional apprenticeship looks like?
Yeah, and it can feel a lot bigger than what it needs to be. I mean, in a perfect world, if you could just get a new volunteer, let's say they're a new small group leader in kids, or it's a new person on the guest services team that's going to greet and hand out the program, or it's, a new adult small group leader. If they can just serve with somebody who's already doing it four times and have specific conversations around that, and the way I think of it is checklists. So if you can make it, and we have, a lot of times we have checklists that at my church, and I've used some from other churches where it's like, hey, here's, 15 things that we're going to cover, your first month of serving, your first four serves or whatever that looks like. And we're going to just talk about it. And you're going to ask me, like, let's say Bart, I'm new, and Bart, you're the person that's the veteran leader. I'm going to ask you about these things. And one of them might be literally like, where do I get the curriculum? And you're like, oh, it's right over here. Yeah. Or like, what if a kid in my group has to use the bathroom? Oh, okay. You know what I'm saying? Or like, what is, I've read the emergency plan, but like, how does that actually work in this room? And Bart, you're like, okay, we line up here and then we go out that door. And it's hard to do that, especially in a kids ministry or student ministry in the moment, right? Because it's like, you're just, all these things are going on, but it's pretty easy to do it in 5 to 10 minutes before or after you serve. So that's all that has to be is intentional checklist of things that you're going to learn and somebody that you're going to get paired with to ask those questions to. And as best as possible, it's not you as the ministry leader, because you'd become a bottleneck. Like everybody has to come to you. It's somebody who's already doing it that they're going to serve alongside. So that's what that is. And if you could do that, I don't even know if this is true. I made this up, but in the book, I say that I believe, and I genuinely do believe this, that a really good apprenticeship program where you're training them, like maybe even with some stuff they watch on their own as they're onboarding and then some checklists they go through in person and a good orientation, you can get somebody to 80% of what they need for the role in the first, two months doing a good apprenticeship. And then every other training after that is getting them from 80 to, well, there is no 100 because we're never there.
Yeah.
So whatever that looks like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I really do believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. That having someone that you can, it's more than just shadowing. It's more than just observation. At this point, it's actually doing it together and actually having some input and feedback on how that's going. I love that. The last phase or step in your onboarding process is follow-up and placement. Define that. What does that actually mean?
Yeah. And it's easy to just think, well, that's easy. They're serving now. I'm done. But I genuinely believe that retention of a new volunteer is highly dependent upon a few things. One, relationships that they build on the team. That's probably one of the most important things. Two, how well they were trained in the onboarding process so that they feel confident. It's hard to keep serving in a role, that you can't feel confident in. So that training is big. But then the other third piece, which I think is key here, is following up with them about 6 weeks in and asking, hey, how's it going? What makes sense? What doesn't? What doesn't make sense? We have a 6-week follow-up question document where somebody meets with you and it's like, what has energized you about this role? What has drained you? What has frustrated you? I know Andy Stanley one time said they asked this question. I thought it was great. So we put it in there. It was, what do we do that doesn't make sense or seems off purpose?
Hmm.
So that's more of an evaluation of us really than of them. But you can't know that a year in because you're in it. You don't see it anymore.
Right.
But 6 weeks in, you could be like, why do we go here when we're just going to go there 5 minutes later? You know, like,
yeah.
Or, you know what I mean? Like, why are the resources here when we then have to go outside the room to get them and leave the kids alone? You know, things like that. So I think if you follow up, meet with people and ask those questions. Okay. And that is the time though, where it's like, hey, if I was meeting with you and you were my leader, I'm not sure if this is the fit. I'm actually starting to think it's more middle school. And you're like, okay, you know, you put your church-wide hat on, we're all one team. That's the place for that. And then they stick long-term. So it's not just, hey, you're in. Bart, I'll see you Sunday. And you're like, what do I do? I don't know. I'll be busy. You're not going to be able to find me. Good luck. You know, you got to equip them. And it's even the practical things like, do they have a name tag? Where do they get the resources? What time do they show up? You know what I mean? Like, help them have a great first experience. Even if, I mean, let's face it, we're all in ministry situations where we're like plugging 18 holes in the boat. And here comes the new volunteer. You're like, come on board.
Yeah.
Put your finger there. That's going to happen. But as best as possible, give them a pretty good start and a pretty quick follow-up 2 months in or so. See how they're doing.
Yeah. Love that. In terms of time commitment, you know, one of the things that you said early on is that, you know, sometimes they don't say yes because they think that they're going to be stuck, you know, changing diapers until Jesus comes back, right? Like, yep, if I say yep, yes, is yep. there a way for me to get out of this? What's your typical procedure or policy on how you offboard people in a way that's healthy for both the church and the individual?
Yeah, this is a great question because, like, and pastors would know this more than anybody. I mean, the pastors have to develop that muscle of like people leaving their church and it feeling personal. And like betrayal, especially even if it's they were close, or maybe they were an elder, maybe they were on staff, maybe they were a key leader. So pastors more than anybody feel the pain of that. And a lot of people leave bad, you know, whether it's bad because it was toxic and they said things or messed things up on the way out. Most people leave bad because they leave quietly. They don't say anything. And I, going back to boldness, I feel like, you know, one of our values as a staff is to be bold and courageous with people. And my pastor has taught well for years. That we can be bold with people. And so if somebody just ghosts and disappears, you know, try to follow up with them. Try to have that conversation they're not wanting to have. But we also have to be okay hearing what they say. You know, one of our staff had one of these just literally 2 days ago. And it's like, okay. And you know, maybe we need to own 80% of that and they own 20, or maybe they need to own 80 and we own 20. Well, as my executive pastor would say, we need to own 100% of our 10% or whatever our percent is. So I think it's just following up with them. And then again, big picture, kingdom mindset, you know, we're not making them feel bad. But the other thing too is, and this is hard to do, a lot of churches don't do this, don't get me wrong. But if you can track that, that would be helpful. Like, what are how many volunteers are you losing? So, and I don't mean losing in a bad way, but like they stepped off, they're having a baby, you know, versus how many are you gaining? Because sometimes you don't really know, is this a retention problem or a recruitment problem? And I don't, Bart, I know very few churches that actually track how many people step off a volunteer team every year. But if you can, it helps. You figure out where the issues are.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. Hey, we only have a few minutes left with our time together today, and I want to shift gears here a little bit and have you share a little bit about something you shared with me a couple of years ago, which is an opportunity for churches to qualify for a FEMA grant that could allow them to get some security equipment in their church buildings. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of churches about this. Some of them have very mixed emotions about taking federal money for anything. But
sure.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what your experience is? What is it in general? And you know, how churches can apply for it, and how you and your ministry organization are actually helping churches in the case that they need help acquiring it.
Yeah, my business partner, Kenny Conley, was at a church in Arizona years ago where the security director was former either FBI or police or something like that. And he knew about this back in like 2008 or something. And their church had received it 3 times, you know, over a 12, 15-year span. It's called the Nonprofit Security Grant Program. It's run by FEMA, but it's administered by the local states. So you would only talk to your state, and then they talk to FEMA almost like on your behalf. like a agent or a lawyer or something. And every year that grant opens up, the timing is dependent. Usually it's May, June, but it always depends on the budget year. This year, it's right now. It has opened up federally. They don't, as the time we're recording this, deadlines haven't been announced. And every state is different. You know, they generally, FEMA has their deadline for states, and then states set their deadline based off of that. But essentially, you can get up to $200,000 for church security, for security. I mean, it's for any nonprofit 501c3. All churches qualify, even if you don't have a 501c3. Up to $200,000 per physical address. So there's some church, like I've worked with churches that are multi-site and they have two campuses, and so they could get, and up to three addresses per year you can apply for. So like my church actually has a separate office building from our main building. So we applied for two years ago. Back then the maximum was 150K per, and we got 150 at one and 100 at the other. But the people can find out more if they go to ministryboost.org under resources, find the one that says $200,000 grants for church security. And we run like an automated webinar every 2 hours, talk all through the details. There are, I mean, I do have churches, not a big percentage, but probably, if I had to guess, maybe 5% of the churches I talk to opt not to do it because it is money from the government. But there really aren't real concerns there. Like people think there are a lot of times you think they're going to meddle in this and, you know, whatever. And that's just not been true. You know, it's not been true of anybody. I mean, that one church in Arizona has had three times and over 15 years and literally had no issues. We got ours 2 years ago, installed all that security system, alarms, cameras.
Yeah. Speak a little bit, Nick, to what you can use it for and what you can't use it for.
Yeah. The whole point is to stop, like help prevent terrorist attacks. And so it's for facility hardening specifically. So think cameras, alarms, door access control, key card entry type things, fences, bollards, the things that stop a car from driving through a building, blast-resistant glass covering, things like that. Even training, you can up to 5% can be actually used to pay for administration of the grant. So think like if you had a volunteer in your church and you were going to kind of throw them some money to help do this, you could ask for up to 5% of the 200 grand, so that'd be 10 grand, and you could pay them for that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but
not more than that. And so you apply. And again, you watch the webinar, you get all those details. And we do help churches with it even more than that. If we have a product where we help them with, you know, they can see our application and we've recorded a bunch of videos about how to do it. Because it is it can feel like a daunting thing, but it really isn't. It's a grant. You have to write the application the right way. You can't make mistakes, all those kinds of things.
And I remember I talking about it before, and you said that you see a pretty significant percentage of churches that apply for it actually get it. By the way, is that a dog crying in the background or a human crying in the background at your house?
A human crying in the background.
My human crying.
A younger one's came in. Yeah. Okay. No, my dog was even louder. I don't know where he is either. That is a good question, but you're gonna have to ask it to me again because I already got sidetracked when you asked about the kids.
Yeah, I get it. You were distracted. I was distracted.
I was like, that is a good question. We should hit that.
Yeah. Percentage of churches that actually qualify. Are you
I don't know if it was 23 or I think it was 23. Half the organizations that applied roughly got it because there was, and the only reason I know this is because sometimes they'll come out and tell you, you know, X number of organizations applied, X number got it. And so if you just did the math, it was like, well, 50% got it. Well, the reality is your odds are way better than that because most of the 50% that didn't get it messed it up. They didn't do the address right here. They didn't use the right program to create the application. They didn't do this at all. And so we helped in the spring of last year, about 50 churches, all but two of them got it. And the two that didn't, one's in Maryland where I live, and they would not agree with me, I bet, but I'm confident there's a waiting list here that you have to get, because that happened to us. We didn't get the first year, same application next year, got both. And then the other one was in Florida. And quite honestly, his application was really light and he didn't do the final review call with us. Had he done that, we would have caught that and beefed up that application. He probably would have done better. So, and then there was a bonus round last November, December, and they still haven't heard yet, which is odd. That should have been announced by now. So we've helped about 100 churches so far. Now we're up to about 120 and your odds are good. The way I say it is if you're willing to apply for a couple years in a row, 2-3 years, if you take that mindset, your odds are really good. 80-90% plus.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's a great opportunity for churches, especially a smaller church that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of resources. These are obviously not monies that you can spend, you know, spiffing up your building and things. But if you don't have cameras, you need cameras. You need security cameras inside, outside the property. If you don't have access doors that are keyed or coded properly, this is a great opportunity for you to upgrade doors and things like that, that can allow you to have both more security, but also they'll just probably look better than maybe some of the old doors you got in the building. Mm-hmm. Some really great opportunities there. And I hope that those that are listening will dig into this a little bit further. Check out your website. Is it the Ministry Boost website or is it nickblevins.com?
Just go, not, I should put it on there, but I didn't, but go to ministryboost.org under resources. You can just watch that webinar. And like, even what you said, you can actually get actual doors because that's an example of something that's facility hardening.
Yeah.
Now you're not getting, like I saw somebody commented on one of our posts one time, like we can upgrade our audio video booth. It's like, no, you can't. Yeah. But you know, you can, and even a church, like a lot of times a church will say, hey, we're church of 80, our building's, you know, 12,000 square feet or 8,000 square feet. And it's like, you'd be surprised how much some of this stuff costs. You could spend the $200,000, almost any church, you know, could, with great integrity, spend that money on this and have it help improve their thing. And we've run our system now for a couple of years and it's been great.
Yeah. Well, I threw a couple of different web addresses out there. There are a lot of places that you can find Nick Blevins online. Best places, ministryboost.org, nickblevins.com.
That's it. I think those two will take care of most of it.
The book's available on Amazon. You can Google it, The Volunteer Playbook by Nick Blevins. It's also listed on the website. Nick, we're going to shut this thing down now. I always enjoy hanging out with you. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your insight and experience with our audience today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bart.
For those of you who made it all the way to the end, congratulations. This has been a pretty long episode, but hopefully it's been worth your while. Thanks again for tuning in to the Revitalize My Church podcast. Just a reminder that if you haven't yet subscribed or ever you listen to your favorite podcasts, do that. We drop episodes on the 1st and the 15th of every month. That's really hard to remember. So if you just subscribe, they get delivered to your mobile device and you don't have to remember. We'll see you next time.